accompany Napoleon to the island of Elba. At Waterloo, he led a squadron of cuirassiers in Dubois' brigade. He was the one who took the colours of the Lunebourg battalion. He went and threw the colours at the Emperor's feet. He was covered in blood. In seizing the colours, he had received a sabre cut across his face. The Emperor, pleased, shouted to him, "You are a colonel! You are a baron! You are an officer of the Légion d'honneur!" Pontmercy replied, "Sir, I thank you on my widow's behalf." 1 hour later, he fell into the Ohain gully. Now, what was this Georges Pontmercy? He was this same brigand of the Loire. We have already seen something of his history. After Waterloo, having been pulled out of the sunken road of Ohain, Pontmercy had managed to get back to the army and had dragged himself from ambulance to ambulance as far as the billets of the Loire. The restoration put him on half pay, then put him in a home, in other words, under surveillance, in Vernon. King Louis XVIII, considering as null and void anything that had been done in the Hundred Days, recognized neither his standing as officer of the Légion d'honneur, nor his rank as colonel, nor his title as baron. He, for his part, never missed an opportunity to sign himself Colonel Baron Pontmercy. He had only an old blue coat and never went out without pinning on it the rosette of an officer of the Légion d'honneur. The Crown prosecutor put him on notice that he would be prosecuted for illegal wearing of said decoration. When this notice was handed to him by an officious intermediary, Pontmercy answered with a bitter smile, "I don't know if it is I who no longer understand French, or you who no longer speak it, but the fact is I don't understand a word." He promptly stepped out every day for a week with his rosette in place. No one dared rile him. Two or three times, the war minister and the general commanding the département wrote to him, addressing him as Major Pontmercy. He set the letters back, marked "Return to Sender," unopened. At that same moment, Napoleon on St. Helena was dealing similarly with the missives of Sir Hudson Lowe addressed to General Bonaparte. Pontmercy had ended up with the same bile in his mouth, if you'll forgive the expression, as his emperor. In Rome, too, there were Carthaginian soldiers taken prisoner who had a little of Hannibal's soul and refused to salute Flaminius. One morning, he came across the Crown prosecutor in a street in Vernon, went up to him and said, "Monsieur Procureur du Roi, am I allowed to wear my scar?" He had nothing but his measly half-pay as squadron chief to live on, and so he had rented the smallest house he could find in Vernon. He lived there alone, how we have just seen. Under the Empire, between the wars, he had found time to marry Mademoiselle Gillenormand. The old bourgeois, outraged at heart, had consented with a sigh and this remark, "The greatest families are forced to do it." In 1815, Madame Pontmercy, who was in all things admirable in any case, high-minded and rare and worthy of her husband, had died, leaving a child. This child would have been the pride and joy of the colonel in his loneliness. But the grandfather had imperiously claimed his grandson, declaring that if he was not handed over, he would disinherit him. The father had yielded in the little boy's interests, and, not being able to have his son, had turned to flowers. He had given up everything, anyway, neither aspiring nor conspiring. He divided his thoughts between the innocuous things he now did and the great things he had done. He passed his time either anticipating a carnation or remembering Austerlitz. Monsieur Gillenormand had no contact with his son-in-law. The colonel was for him a bandit, and he was for the colonel an old codger. Monsieur Gillenormand never spoke of the colonel except occasionally to make some scathing allusion to his barony. It was expressly agreed that Pontmercy would never try to see his son or to speak to him, or the boy would be handed back, driven out, and disinherited. For the Gillenormands, Pontmercy was a leper. They intended to bring the child up as they pleased. The colonel was perhaps wrong to accept these conditions, but he bowed to them, believing he was doing the right thing and hurting only himself. Old man Gillenormand's legacy was nothing much, but the legacy for Mademoiselle Gillenormand, the elder, was considerable. This aunt, who had remained unmarried, was extremely rich on her mother's side, and the son of her sister was her natural heir. The child, who was called Marius, knew he had a father, but that's as far as it went. Nobody breathed a word to him about him, but in the social world his grandfather took him to, the whispers, hints, and winks finally ended up coming together in the little boy's mind. He wound up understanding something, and as he naturally picked up by a sort of slow trickle-down process like osmosis, the ideas and opinions that were, so to speak, the air he breathed, little by little he came to think of his father only with a lump in his throat and a sense of shame. While he was growing up in this fashion, two or three times a month, the colonel would escape and speed furtively to Paris, like a fugitive from justice breaking his bands, and head for Saint-Sulpice, where he would take up his post at the hour when Aunt Gillenormand took Marius to Mass. There, shaking for fear that the aunt would turn round, hiding behind a pillar, motionless, hardly daring to breathe, he would watch his son. This battle-scarred hero was afraid of the old maid. It was actually from this that his friendship with the curé de Vernon, Abbé Mabeuf, came about. This worthy priest was the brother of a Saint-Sulpice church warden who had several times noticed the man gazing at the child, and the scar on his cheek, and the fat tears in his eyes. This man, who looked so much the man and yet cried like a woman, had struck the church warden. The face stayed in his mind. One day, having gone to Vernon to visit his brother, he came across Colonel Pontmercy on the bridge and recognized the man from Saint-Sulpice. The churchwarden spoke to the curé about it, and they both paid the colonel a visit on some pretext or other. This visit led to others. The colonel was at first very closed, but finally opened up, and the priest and the churchwarden came to know the whole story, and how Pontmercy had sacrificed his own happiness to his son's future. This caused the curé to feel real veneration and tenderness for him, and the colonel, on his side, took to the curé with affection. In any case, whenever both happen to be sincere and good, no one gets on as well or becomes as close as an old priest and an old soldier. Deep down, they are the same man. One has dedicated himself to the homeland here below, the other to the homeland up above. There is no other difference. Twice a year, on the 1st of January and on St. George's feast day, Marius wrote dutiful letters to his father that his aunt dictated and that you would have said were copied from some manual. This was all Monsieur Gillenormand would tolerate, and the father answered, with overwhelmingly tender letters, that the old man pocketed without reading. Requiescant, R.I.P. The salon of Madame T. was all that Marius Pontmercy knew of the world. It was the sole opening through which he could look at life. This opening was grim, and such a tiny window on the world brought him more cold than heat, more darkness than daylight. This child, who was all joy and light whenever he stepped into this strange world, became sad there in a very short space of time, and, what is even more unusual at his age, grave. Surrounded by all these imposing and singular persons, he looked around him with serious amazement. Everything conspired to intensify his stupefaction. There were in Madame de T.'s salon noble and extremely venerable old ladies named Matan, Noé, Lévy, Cambyse. These antique figures with their biblical names got mixed up in the little boy's mind with the Old Testament that he was learning by heart. And when they were all there together, sitting in a circle around a dying fire, scarcely illuminated by a lamp veiled in green, with their severe profiles, their gray or white hair, their long frocks from another age with their morbid colors that were barely discernible, dropping words at once majestic and savage at rare intervals, little Marius would study them with startled eyes, believing that he saw not real beings, but phantoms. Blending in with these phantoms were several priests, habitués of the old salon, and a few gentlemen, the Marquis de Sassenay, secretary-in-chief to Madame du Barry, the Vicomte de Valory, who published monorhymed odes under the pseudonym of Charles Antoine, the Prince de Beaufremont, who, though still fairly young, was going grey and who had a pretty and witty wife, whose extremely low-cut scarlet velvet frocks with gold trim scared off the gloom. The Marquis de Corioli d'Espinouse, the man in all France who best managed measured politeness, the Comte de Mandre, a good old stick with a benevolent chin, and the Chevalier de Portigny, pillar of the Bibliothèque du Louvre, which was known as the King's Study. Monsieur de Portigny, bald and more elderly than old, reckoned that in 1793, when he was 16 years old, he had been thrown into jail as a recalcitrant and chained to an octogenarian, the Bishop of Mirepoix. Also a recalcitrant, only as a priest, whereas he was a recalcitrant soldier. This was in Toulon. Their job had been to go at night and collect from the scaffold the heads and bodies of those guillotined during the day. They then carried off these steaming trunks on their backs, and their red convict smocks had a permanent crust of blood at the back of the neck, wet at night, dry in the morning. Such tragic tales abounded in the salon of Madame Dutilly, and by dint of cursing Marat, they were forced to applaud the terrorist Trestaillon. A few deputies of the kind that can't be pinned down played their whist there. Monsieur Thibault du Chalard, Monsieur le Marchand de Gomicourt, and the celebrated right-wing comic Monsieur Corneille d'Ancourt. The bailiff of Ferret, with his short breeches and his skinny legs, occasionally breezed through the salon on his way to Monsieur de Talleyrand. He had been the boon companion in debauchery of the Comte d'Artois, and in a move that was the complete reverse of Aristotle squatting under Compaspe, he had made La Guimard walk around on all fours, thereby displaying for all the ages the image of a philosopher avenged by a bailiff. As for the priests, these were the Abbé Alma, the same to whom Monsieur Larose, his collaborator at the Foudre, said, "Bah! Who isn't at least 50 years old? A few whippersnappers, perhaps?" The Abbé Letourneur, preacher to the king, the Abbé Fresenou, who was not yet a count, or a bishop, or a minister, or a peer, and who wore an old soutane with the buttons missing, and the Abbé Caravenon, curé of Saint-Germain-des-Prés, plus the Pope's nuncio, at that time Monsignor Macchi, Archbishop of Nisibis, later cardinal, remarkable for his long, pensive nose, and another Monsignor with the title Abate Palmieri, domestic prelate, one of the 7 participating protonotaries of the Holy See, canon of the insignia of the Liberian Basilicate, advocate of the saints, Postulatore di Santi, which deals with matters of canonization and, more or less, means master of requests for the Paradise branch. And last 2 cardinals, Monsieur de la Luzerne and Monsieur de Clermont-Tonnerre. Monsieur le Cardinal de Luzerne was a writer and was to have the honour, a few years later, of signing articles in the Conservateur alongside Chateaubriand. Monsieur de Clermont-Tonnerre was Archbishop of Toulouse and often came to Paris on holiday, staying with his nephew, the Marquis de Tonnerre, who had been a minister of the Navy and of War. The Cardinal de Clermont-Tonnerre was a chirpy little old-timer who flashed a bit of a red stocking underneath a hitched-up soutane. His specialty was hating the encyclopedia and being mad about billiards, and anyone out and about on a summer evening who happened to stroll down the Rue Madame, where the Hôtel de Clermont-Tonnerre then was, would stop to listen to the clicking of billiard balls and the sharp voice of the cardinal yelling at his fellow conclavist, Monseigneur Cotteret, bishop in partibus of Cariste, "See that, abbé? I'm sending them crashing!" The Cardinal de Clermont-Tonnerre had been brought along to Madame de Tise by his closest friend, Monsieur de Roquelaure, former bishop of Senlis and one of the famous 40, the 40 members of the Académie Française. Monsieur de Roquelaure was impressive for his great height and his zeal at the Académie. Through the glass door of the adjoining room of the library, where the Académie Française then held its sessions every Thursday, the curious could contemplate the former bishop of Senlis, habitually on his feet, freshly powdered and in violet stockings, and with his back turned to the door, apparently the better to show off his little cape. Though most were men of the court as much as men of the church, all these ecclesiastics added to the gravity of the tea salon, whose seigneurial side was accentuated by five peers of France: the Marquis de Vibray, the Marquis de Talaru, the Marquis d'Herbouville, the Vicomte d'Ambray, and the Duc de Valentinois. This Duc de Valentinois, though Prince of Monaco, that is, a foreign sovereign prince, had such an elevated idea of France and of the peerage that he saw everything in terms of them. It was he who said, "Cardinals are the Roman peers of France. Lords are the English peers of France." And the funny thing was, for in this century the revolution has to muscle in everywhere, that this impeccably feudal salon was, as we have said, dominated by a bourgeois. Monsieur Gillenormand held sway there. This, then, was the essence and quintessence of white, legitimist Paris society. People of renown were shunned there, even when they were royalists. There is always a bit of anarchy in renown. Had Chateaubriand set foot there, he would have had the same effect as Père Duchesne. A few royalists who had rallied to the Republic managed to penetrate this orthodox world, though only under sufferance. Comte Beugnot was received there as a matter of good manners. The noble salons of today no longer bear any resemblance to those salons. The current Faubourg Saint-Germain has a whiff of heresy about it. The royalists of the moment are demagogues, to their credit, we might add. In the superior world of Madame de T's salon, taste was exquisite and exalted, buoyed by the most flowery politeness. Little customs there involved all manner of unconscious refinements, which were the ancien régime itself, buried but alive. Some of these customs, especially the linguistic ones, now seem bizarre. Superficial observers would have taken as provincial what was merely old-fashioned. A woman would be referred to as Madame la Générale, and Madame la Colonelle had not entirely fallen out of use. The charming Madame de Léon, no doubt in memory of the Duchesses de Longueville and de Chevreuse, preferred this form of address to her title of Princesse. The Marquise de Créqui, too, called herself Madame la Colonelle. It was this rarefied small world that invented the refinement of always, when speaking to the king in closed circles at the Tuileries, referring to him in the third person as the king and ever Your Majesty, the term Your Majesty having been besmirched by the usurper. Events and people were put on trial there. The age was mightily mocked, which exempted a person from trying to understand it. They bolstered each other's stunned amazement. They each passed on to the rest what little light they could shed. Methuselah informed Epimenides. The deaf kept the blind up to speed. The time that had gone by since Koblenz was declared non-existent. Just as Louis XVIII was in the 25th year of his reign, by the grace of God, so the émigrés were, by rights, in the 25th year of their adolescence. All was harmony. No one was too much alive. Speech was barely a whisper, and a newspaper, in keeping with the salon, was like papyrus. There were young people there, but they were all a bit dead. In the antechamber, the liveried attendants were dowdy, for those completely out-of-date characters were waited on by domestics of the same ilk. Everything had the air of having lived a long time ago and of holding out doggedly against the grave. Conserve, conservation, conservative, that was more or less the entire lexicon. To smell good, that was the thing. Indeed, aromatics entered into the opinions of these venerable bastions, and their ideas reeked of violets. It was a mummified world. The masters were embalmed, the valets were stuffed. A worthy old Marquis émigré, who had returned ruined, with only one maid left, went on saying, "My people." What did they do in Madame de T's salon? They were ultra, that is, ultra-royalists. This word no longer means anything today, although what it represents has not perhaps entirely disappeared. We should explain. To be ultra is to go one better. It is to attack the scepter in the name of the throne and the mitre in the name of the altar. It is to maltreat the thing you trundle around. It is to kick over the traces. It is to quibble with the steak over the degree of cooking required for heretics. It is to attack the idol for lacking in idolatry, to insult through excessive respect, to find too little popery in the Pope, too little royalty in the King, and too much light in night. It is to find alabaster, snow, the swan, and the lily sadly wanting when it comes to whiteness, to support things in a partisan spirit to the point where you become their enemy. It is to be so strongly for that you are against. The ultra spirit is especially characteristic of the initial phase of the Restoration. Nothing in history remotely resembles those 15 minutes that begin in 1814 and end around 1820 with the advent of Monsieur de Villèle, the pragmatist of the right. Those 6 years were an extraordinary interlude, both noisy and grim, sunny and somber, luminous with the radiance of a new dawn and smothered in the gloom of the great catastrophes still choking the horizon, only slowly sinking into the past. In all that light and dark, a whole little world, new and old, comical and sad, juvenile and senile, stood there rubbing its eyes. Nothing resembles an awakening so much as a return. This world regarded France with bad-tempered wistfulness, and France regarded it with irony. The streets were full of marquises who looked like wise old owls, revenants and returned émigrés ci-devant. Stunned by everything, brave and noble gentlemen beaming at being back in France, and weeping over it too. Thrilled to see their homeland again, and in despair not to find the monarchy still in place. The nobility of the Crusades booing off the stage the nobility of the empire, meaning the nobility of the sword. Historic clans who had lost the thread of history. Sons of the companions of Charlemagne looking down on the companions of Napoleon. Swords, as we said, batted insults back and forth. The sword of Fontenoy was laughable, nothing more than a stick of rust. The sword of Marengo was base, nothing more than a saber. Yesteryear disowned yesterday. The sense of what was great was lost along with a sense of the ridiculous. Someone called Bonaparte, Scapin the Clown, that world is no more. Nothing, we repeat, is left of it today. Whenever we happen to dredge up some feature of it and try to bring it to life again in imagery, it seems as strange to us as something from some antediluvian world. The fact is that it, too, has been engulfed by a deluge like the biblical flood. It has disappeared beneath two revolutions. Ideas are such torrents. How swiftly they cover all they set out to destroy and bury, and how promptly they create terrifyingly fathomless depths. Such were the features of the salons of those distant and candid times when Monsieur de Martainville was considered wittier than Voltaire. These salons had their very own literature and politics. They believed in Fievé there. Monsieur Agier ruled. They commented on Monsieur Colnet, the specialist in public law, who was a second-hand bookseller, a bouquiniste, on the Quai Malaquais. Napoleon came into his own as the ogre of Corsica there. Later on, the entry into history of Monsieur le Marquis Buonaparte, lieutenant-general of the king's armies, was a concession to the spirit of the age. These salons did not stay pure for long. As early as 1818, a few doctrinaire types began to crop up in them, which was a disquieting development. The tactics these types employed were to carry on like royalists, but apologize for it. Where the ultras were extremely proud of who they were, the doctrinaires were a bit shamefaced. They were witty, but they were a little too silent. Their political dogma was properly starched with arrogance. But they were a little too driven. They overdid the white cravats and buttoned-up coats, though this was effective. The mistake or misfortune of the doctrinaire party lay in creating old young people. They adopted the pose of sages. They dreamed of grafting moderate power on absolute and excessive principle. They opposed, sometimes with a rare intelligence, a destructive liberalism with a conservative liberalism. They could be heard saying, "Go easy on royalism. It hasn't done too badly. It has brought back tradition, worship, religion, respect. It is loyal, brave, chivalrous, loving, devout. It has come to infuse, however regretfully, the new splendors of the nation with the secular splendors of the monarchy. It is wrong not to understand the revolution, the empire, glory, liberty, new ideas, the younger generations, the age. But the wrong that it does us, don't we sometimes do the same wrong to it? The revolution, whose heirs we are, ought to understand everything. To attack royalism is misdirected on the part of liberalism. What a mistake, and what blindness! Revolutionary France lacks respect for historic France, that is, its mother, that is, itself. After the 5th of September, the nobility of the monarchy was treated the same way as the nobility of the empire was treated after the 8th of July. They were unjust about the eagle, just as we are unjust about the fleur-de-lis. We always have to have something to outlaw. Removing the gilt from Louis XIV's crown, scratching Henri IV's coat of arms, is that really helpful? We laugh at Monsieur de Vaublanc for effacing the ends from the Pont d'Iéna. What on earth was he doing? Exactly what we are doing now. Bouvines is as much ours as Marengo. The fleur-de-lis belongs to us just as much as those ends. It is our heritage. What's the good of diminishing it? We should no more deny our homeland in the past than in the present. Why not embrace all of history? Why not love all of France? This is how the doctrinaires criticized and defended royalism, which did not like being criticized and was furious at being defended. The ultras marked the first phase of royalism. The congregation characterized the second. Ardor was elbowed aside by cunning. Let's leave this sketch right there. In the course of this tale, the author of this book has come across this curious moment in contemporary history on his travels. He could not help but cast a glance at it in passing and outline some of the singular features of that long-lost social world. But he does so rapidly and without a hint of bitterness or derision. Memories, fond and respectful, since they touch on his mother, attach him to that past. Besides, let's admit it, this same small world had its grandeur. You can smile about it, but you can't despise or hate it. It was the France of days gone by. Marius Pontmercy, like all children, received some sort of education or other. Once he was off his Aunt Gillenormand's hands, his grandfather put him in the care of a worthy professor of the purest classical innocence. This budding young soul changed hands from a prude to a pedantic prig. Marius had his years of college, then he entered law school. He was royalist, fanatical, and an aesthete. He had little love for his grandfather, whose frivolity and cynicism rubbed him the wrong way, and his heart was dark in relation to his father. Apart from that, he was an ardent but aloof boy, noble, generous, proud, religious, exalted, dignified to the point of being hard, pure to the point of being savage. End of the Brigand. The completion of Marius's classical studies coincided with Monsieur Gillenormand's exit from the world. The old man said goodbye to the Faubourg Saint-Germain and to the salon of Madame de T, and went and set up in the Marais in his house on the Rue des Filles du Calvaire. In addition to the porter, his servants included the particular Nicolette, who had taken over from the Magnon woman as chambermaid, and the huffing and puffing Basque we spoke of earlier. In 1827, Marius had just turned 17. One night, when he came home, he saw his grandfather with a letter in his hand. "Marius," said Monsieur Gillenormand, "you will leave tomorrow for Vernon." "Why?" said Marius. "To see your father." Marius gave a shudder. He had thought of everything but this, that the day might come when he would have to see his father. Nothing could have been more unexpected, more surprising, and, we have to say, more unpleasant. It was distance forced into proximity, compulsory intimacy. There was no chagrin, no, it was just a tiresome chore. Apart from his feelings of political antipathy, Marius was convinced that his father, the swashbuckler, as Monsieur Gillenormand called him on his better days, did not love him. This was obvious, since he had clearly abandoned him, leaving him to the care of others. Feeling himself to be unloved, he did not feel love either. As simple as that, he told himself. He was so stunned that he did not question Monsieur Gillenormand. The grandfather went on.
It appears he is sick. He is asking for you.
After a silence, he added,
Go tomorrow morning. I believe there is a coach that leaves from the Cour de Fontaine at 6 o'clock and gets there in the evening. Take it. He says it's urgent.
He then screwed the letter up and shoved it in his pocket. Marius could have left that same night and been at his father's side the following morning. A coach from the Rue du Bouloir made the trip to Rouen at night in those days, and it passed through Vernon. But neither Monsieur Gillenormand nor Marius thought of inquiring. The next day at dusk, Marius arrived in Vernon. Candles were just being lit as he asked the first person he came across for the home of Monsieur Pontmercy. For in his thoughts he was of the same view as the Restoration, and he too did not acknowledge his father as either a baron or a colonel. A building was pointed out to him. He rang the bell. A woman came and opened the door, a small lamp in hand. "Monsieur Pontmercy?" said Marius. The woman did not move. "Is this the place?" The woman gave an affirmative nod of the head. "Could I speak to him?" The woman gave a negative shake of the head. "But I'm his son," Marius went on. "He's expecting me." "Not any more, he's not," said the woman. It was then that he noticed she was in tears. She pointed to the door of a low-ceilinged room. He went in. In this room, which was lit by a tallow rushlight sitting on the mantelpiece, there were three men, one standing, one kneeling, one on the floor stretched out in his shirt sleeves on the tiles. The one on the floor was the colonel. The other two were a doctor and a priest who was busily praying. The colonel had been struck down by brain fever 3 days before. At the onset of the disease, having a bad premonition, he had written to Monsieur Gillenormand to ask for his son. His condition had deteriorated. The very evening Marius arrived in Vernon, the colonel had had a bout of delirium. He had gotten out of bed, in spite of the servant, crying, "My son hasn't arrived yet. I'll go and wait for him." He promptly ran out of his room and fell on the tiled floor of the antechamber. He had only just died. The doctor and the curé had been sent for. The doctor had got there too late. The curé had got there too late. The son, too, had got there too late. By the crepuscular light of the candle, you could make out on the cheeks of the pale and prostrate colonel the fat tears that had run from his death-stricken eyes. The eyes were extinguished, but the tears had not yet dried. Those tears were the son's delay. Marius gazed at this man, seeing him for the first and the last time. That noble, manly face, the open eyes that did not see, the white hair, the robust limbs on which you could make out the brown lines of saber cuts and the red stars of bullet holes here and there. He gazed at the gigantic scar that stamped heroism on this face where God had imprinted goodness. He thought how this man was his father, and the man was dead. And he remained unmoved. The sadness he felt was the sadness he would have felt confronted by any man he had seen lying there, dead. Yet mourning, a poignant mourning, was in that room. The servant lamented in a corner by herself. The curé prayed and could be heard sobbing. The doctor dried his eyes. The corpse itself wept. The doctor, the priest, and the woman looked at Marius in their affliction without saying a word. He was the stranger here. Marius, too little moved, felt awkward and ashamed of his attitude. He had his hat in his hand, and so he let it drop to the floor to make them think he felt so much grief he didn't have the strength to hold on to it. At the same time, He felt something like remorse, and he despised himself for acting this way. But was it his fault? So he didn't love his father. What of it? The colonel left nothing. The sale of his furniture barely paid for his funeral. The servant found a scrap of paper, which she handed to Malus. It was written in the colonel's handwriting. And this is what it contained. For my son. The emperor made me a baron on the battlefield of Waterloo. Since the Restoration contests this title, which I have paid for with my blood, my son will take it and bear it. It goes without saying that he will be worthy of it. On the back, the colonel had added, "At this same Battle of Waterloo, a sergeant saved my life. This man is named Thénardier. In recent times, I believe he was keeping an inn in a village on the outskirts of Paris, in Chelles or Montfermeil. If my son should meet up with him, he will do whatever he can for Thénardier. Not from any sense of religious duty toward his father, but out of that vague respect for death which is always so imperious in the human heart." Marius took the note and held it tight. Nothing else remained of the colonel. Monsieur Gillenormand had his sword and uniform sold to a second-hand clothes dealer. The neighbors raided the garden and made off with the rare flowers there. The other plants became bushy and straggly, or died. Marius had only stayed in Vernon for 48 hours. After the funeral, he went straight back to Paris and got stuck into law again without giving his father another thought, as though his father had never lived. In 2 days, the colonel had been buried, and in 3 days, forgotten. Marius wore a band of crepe on his hat. That was all. The usefulness of going to Mass if you want to be a revolutionary. Marius had stuck to the religious habits of his childhood. One Sunday, when he had gone to hear Mass at Saint-Sulpice, in the same chapel of the Virgin that his aunt used to take him to when he was little, being even more absent-minded and dreamy than usual that day, he took a seat behind a pillar and knelt, without paying it any attention, on a Utrecht velvet chair on the back of which was written the name Monsieur Mabeuf, churchwarden. Mass had scarcely begun when an old man appeared and said to Marius, "Monsieur, that is my place." Marius swiftly moved along, and the old man took his chair. When Mass was over, Marius remained pensive as he moved along. The old man came up again and said to him, "I beg your pardon, monsieur, for having disturbed you a moment ago, and for disturbing you again now, but you must have found me most annoying, and so I must explain." "Monsieur," said Marius, "that is not necessary." "Yes, it is," the old man pursued. "I don't want you to get the wrong idea about me. You see, that place means a lot to me. It seems to me that Mass is better from there. Why? I'll tell you. It is from that place there that I used to watch for years, regularly, every 2 or 3 months. A poor, brave father who had no other opportunity and no other way of seeing his son, because, for family reasons, he was prevented from doing so. He used to come at the time he knew that his son was brought along to Mass. The little boy had no idea that his father was there. Perhaps he didn't even know he had a father. Poor innocent babe. The father, well, he would stand behind that pillar so he couldn't be seen. He would watch his boy and he would cry. He adored the little fellow, that poor man. I could see that. That spot has become sort of sacred for me, and I've got into the habit of going there to hear Mass. I prefer it to the churchwarden's bench I have a right to as churchwarden. I even got to know the poor, unfortunate gentleman a little. He had a father-in-law, a rich sister-in-law, relatives, I don't know exactly, who threatened to disinherit the boy if he, the father, saw him. He sacrificed himself so that his boy would be rich one day and happy. They kept him away from the boy because of his political opinions. Of course, I approve of political opinions, but some people just don't know where to draw the line. My God, because a man was at Waterloo, that doesn't make him a monster.
You don't separate a father from his son for that. He was one of Bonaparte's colonels. He is dead now, I think. He lived in Vernon, where I have a brother who is a curé, and his name was something like Pontmery or Montpercy. He had a beautiful sabre cut, incredible.
Pontmercy? Said Marius, going white.
Exactly, Pontmercy. Did you know him?
Monsieur, said Marius. He was my father. The old churchwarden joined his hands and cried,
Ah, you are the child, yes, that'd be right. He'd have to be a man by now. Well, my poor child, you can say you had a father who loved you more than all the world.
Marius offered the old man his arm and walked him home. The next day he said to Monsieur Gillenormand, We've organized a hunting party with a few friends. Would you mind if I went away for 3 days?
Four, replied the grandfather. Go and enjoy yourself.
And with a wink, he whispered to his daughter, Some little minx.
What it is to have met a churchwarden. Where Marius went, we will see a bit further on. Marius was away for 3 days, then he returned to Paris, where he went straight to the law school library and asked for the collection of the Moniteur. He read the Moniteur, he read all the histories of the Republic and the Empire, the Mémorial de Sainte-Hélène, all the memoirs, newspapers, bulletins, proclamations. He devoured the lot. The first time he came across his father's name in the bulletins of the Grande Armée, he had a fever for a whole week. He went to see the generals under whom Georges Pontmercy had served, among others, the Comte H. Mabeuf, the churchwarden, whom he went to see again, had given him an account of life in Vernon, the colonel's retirement, his flowers, his loneliness. Marius ended up knowing very well this rare, sublime, and gentle man, this rather lamb-like lion, who had been his father. Meanwhile, engrossed as he was in all this study, which took up all his time and all his waking thoughts, he almost never saw the Gillenormands any more. At mealtimes he appeared, then, when they looked for him, he was gone. The aunt grumbled. Old man Gillenormand smiled. Bah, bah, he's at the age when you become girl-crazy. Sometimes the old man would add, Good God, I thought it was just a fling, but it looks like it's real passion. It certainly was real passion. Marius was beginning to worship his father. At the same time, an extraordinary change took shape in his ideas. The phases of this change were numerous and sequential. As this is the story of many minds of our times, we believe it useful to follow these phases step by step and to flag each one. The history he had just cast his eyes on floored him. His initial reaction was dazzlement. The Republic, the Empire, had been nothing but monstrous words for him till that moment. The Republic, a guillotine at dusk, the Empire, a sabre at night. He had now looked into it and found that, where he was expecting only a chaos of darkness, he saw, in a sort of earth-shattering jolt mingled with fear and joy, bright, shining stars. Mirabeau, Vergniaud, Saint-Just, Robespierre, Camille, Desmoulins, Danton. And he had seen a sun rise, Napoleon. He did not know where he was. He reeled back, blinded by so much light. Little by little, when amazement passed, and he got used to this radiance, he gazed upon actions without feeling dizzy. He studied the characters involved without feeling terror. The Revolution and the Empire placed themselves luminously in perspective before his visionary eyes, and he saw how each of these two groups of men and events came down to two hugely momentous developments, the Republic's establishing the sovereignty of civil law and restoring it to the masses, the Empire's establishing the sovereignty of the French ideal and imposing it on Europe. He saw the great figure of the people emerge from the Revolution, and from the Empire, the great figure of France. He declared in his conscience that all that had been for the good. What he neglected in his dazzlement in this initial, far too sweeping assessment, we feel no need to spell out here. We are describing the state of a mind on the move. Progress doesn't happen overnight. That said, once and for all, and for what precedes as well as what follows, we will plough on. He then realized that until that moment, he had not understood his country any more than he had understood his father. He had known neither one nor the other, and he had deliberately kept himself in the dark. Now he could see, and he admired the one and adored the other. He was full of regret and remorse, and he thought with despair how all that his heart held he could now only say to a grave. Oh, if only his father were still alive! If he still had him, if God, in his mercy and goodness, had only allowed his father to go on living, how he would have run, how he would have flown, how he would have cried out to his father, "Father, here I am, it's me, my heart is the same as yours, I am your son." How he would have kissed his old white head, flooded his hair with tears, admired his scar, squeezed his hands, adored his clothes, kissed his feet. Oh, why had his father died so soon, before his time, before justice was done, before his son came to love him? Marius had a permanent sob in his heart that said at every moment, "Alas!" At the same time, he became more genuinely serious, more genuinely grave, more sure of his faith and of his thinking. At every instant, glimmers of the truth carried his reasoning further. A sort of inner growth occurred in him. He felt a sort of natural expansion that these two things brought him, new as they were for him, his father and his country. As though he had a key, everything opened. He could explain to himself what he had hated. He could fathom what he had abhorred. From that moment on, he could see clearly the providential, divine, and human meaning of great things he had been taught to detest, and of great men he had been trained to curse. When he thought of his previous views, which only went back as far as the day before, though they seemed already so old, he felt furious with himself, and he smiled. From the rehabilitation of his father, he naturally went on to the rehabilitation of Napoleon. Yet the latter, to be honest, was pretty hard work. From infancy he had been imbued with the verdict of the party of 1814 concerning Bonaparte. Of course, all the prejudices of the Restoration, all its interests, all its self-serving instincts, tended to disfigure Napoleon. It execrated the man even more than Robespierre. It had exploited cleverly enough the nation's weariness and the hate mothers felt. Bonaparte had become an almost fabulous monster, and in order to defile him in the popular imagination, which, as we pointed out a moment ago, is like the imagination of children, the party of 1814 whipped out every frightening mask it could marshal, one after the other, from the terrible that remains grandiose to the terrible that verges on the grotesque, from Tiberius to the boogeyman. Thus, in speaking of Bonaparte, you were free to sob or to gasp with laughter, provided your reaction was based on hate. Marius had never had, about that man, as he was called, any other notions in his head. They matched the tenacity that was part of his nature. There was in him a stubborn little man who hated Napoleon. By reading history, and especially by studying documents and first-hand records, the veil that hid Napoleon from Marius's eyes was lifted bit by bit. He glimpsed something that was immense, and suspected that he had been wrong about Bonaparte till that moment, as about all the rest. Every day he saw better, and he began to climb, slowly, one by one, almost reluctantly at first, then with intoxication, and, as though drawn by an irresistible fascination, steps that started off dark, then gradually became dimly illuminated, only to end in the luminous and splendid blaze of enthusiasm. One night he was alone in his little room under the eaves. His candle was burning, and he was reading, leaning on the table beside his open window. All kinds of dreamy notions came to him from space and mingled with his thoughts. What a spectacle night is! You hear faint sounds without knowing where they come from. You see Jupiter, which is 1,200 times bigger than Earth, glowing red like embers.
The skies are black, the stars shine. It is tremendous. He was reading the bulletins of the Grande Armée, those Homeric stanzas written on the field of battle. Now and again he saw his father's name there, always the name of the emperor. The whole great empire appeared to him. He felt as though a tide were swelling inside him, and that it was rising. It seemed to him at times that his father brushed past him like a breath and spoke in his ear. He gradually became strange. He thought he could hear drums, cannon, trumpets, the measured tread of the battalions, the dull and distant gallop of the cavalries. From time to time he lifted his eyes to the sky and looked at the colossal constellations glimmering in the limitless depths. Then his eyes dropped back onto his book, and he saw there other colossal things stir in the shadows. His heart was hammering. He was transported, trembling, panting. Suddenly, without knowing himself what had gotten into him and what impulse he was obeying, he stood up, stretched both arms out the window, stared into the darkness, the silence, tenebrous infinity, the eternal immensity, and he shouted, "Long live the Emperor!" From that moment, it was all over. The ogre of Corsica, the usurper, the tyrant, the monster who was his sister's lover, the ham actor who took lessons from Talma, the poisoner of Jaffa, the tiger, Bonaparte, all that evaporated and made way in his mind for an indistinct and dazzling radiance, where the pale marble phantom of Caesar shone out from an inaccessible height. For his father, the emperor had only been the beloved captain you admire and to whom you devote yourself. He was, for Marius, something more. He was the predestined builder of the French order succeeding the Roman order in world domination. He was the prodigious architect of a collapse, the heir of Charlemagne, of Louis XI, of Henri IV, of Richelieu, of Louis XIV, and of the Committee of Public Safety, doubtless having his blemishes, his faults, and even his crimes, for he was human after all. But august in his faults, brilliant in his blemishes, mighty in his crimes. He was the foreordained man of destiny who had forced all nations to say, "That great nation." He was more than this, even. He was the very incarnation of France, conquering Europe by the sword he held in his hand, and the world by the light he gave out. Malus saw in Bonaparte the dazzling specter that will always rise up at the frontier and watch over the future. Dictator, but despot. Despot issuing from a republic and symbolizing a revolution. Napoleon became for him the man who was also the people, just as Jesus was the man who was also God. As you can see, like all newcomers to a religion, he was intoxicated by his conversion, and in his headlong rush to join, he went too far. That was his nature. Once he was on an incline, it was almost impossible for him to hold back. A fanatical passion for the sword took hold of him and muddied his enthusiasm for the ideal. He did not realize that along with the genius, what he admired indiscriminately, was force. In other words, he was setting up in the twin compartments of his idolatry what is divine on one side and, on the other, what is brutal. In several respects he began to deceive himself in other matters. He accepted everything. There is a way of falling into error on the road to truth. He had a kind of violent good faith that swallowed everything outright, lock, stock, and barrel. On this new path he had taken, in condemning the wrongs of the Ancien Régime, and in measuring the glory of Napoleon, he neglected all extenuating circumstances. Be that as it may, a mighty leap had been taken. Where he had once seen the fall of the monarchy, he now saw the emergence of France. His whole orientation had shifted. Sunset had turned into sunrise. He had turned around. All these revolutions were accomplished in him without his family being any the wiser. When, in this mysterious travail, he had completely shed his old Bourbon and ultra skin, when he had stripped off the aristocrat, the Jacobin, and the Royalist when he was fully revolutionary, profoundly democratic, and almost republican. He went to an engraver on the Quai des Orfèvres and ordered from him 100 calling cards bearing this name, Baron Marius Pontmercy, which was merely a perfectly logical consequence of the change that had been effected in him, a change in which everything revolved around his father. Only, as he knew no one and could not spray his cards around to any porters, he stuck them in his pocket. By another natural consequence, the closer he came to his father, to his memory, and to the things for which the colonel had fought for 25 years, the further away he moved from his grandfather. As we said, for a long while Monsieur Gillenormand's outlook had rubbed him the wrong way. There was already between them all the friction there can be between an earnest young man and a frivolous old-timer. Gérant's gaiety shocks and exasperates the melancholy Werther. For as long as they had shared the same political views and the same ideas, Marius had stood together with Monsieur Gillenormand as on a bridge. When the bridge fell, the gulf opened. And then, above all, Marius felt inexpressibly revolted in thinking that it was Monsieur Gillenormand who, for entirely stupid reasons, had torn him mercilessly from the colonel, thereby depriving the father of a son and the son of the father. Out of piety for his father, Marius had almost come to feel aversion for his grandfather. But as we said, nothing of this was betrayed outwardly. Only he grew colder and colder, was laconic at meals, and hardly ever home. When his aunt scolded him for this, he was very sweet and gave as an excuse his studies, courses, exams, symposia, and so on. The grandfather stuck to his infallible diagnosis, "In love! I know what I'm talking about." Every so often, Marius stayed away from home. "Where can he possibly have got to?" his aunt would ask. On one of these excursions afield, which were always very short, he went to Montfermeil in compliance with his father's injunction, and he had looked for the former sergeant of Waterloo, Thénardier, the innkeeper. Thénardier had gone bankrupt, the inn was closed, and nobody knew what had become of him. For this research, Marius was away from home for 4 days.
"Yes, indeed," said the grandfather. "He's going to a lot of trouble."
They thought they noticed that he was wearing something on his chest, under his shirt, and that was attached to his neck by a black ribbon. A bit of skirt. We mentioned a lancer. He was a great-grand-nephew of Monsieur Gillenormand's on the paternal side, and he led the life of the garrison away from the family and far from any domestic hearth. Lieutenant Théodule Gillenormand fulfilled all the desirable criteria of what is known as a good-looking officer. He had a girl's waist, a way of carelessly trailing his victorious sabre, and a handlebar moustache. He only very rarely came to Paris, so rarely that Marius had never set eyes on him. The two cousins knew each other only by name. Théodule was, as I think we said, the favorite of dear old Aunt Gillenormand, who preferred him because she never saw him. Not seeing people allows you to think of them as perfect in all kinds of ways. One morning, Mademoiselle Gillenormand the elder retired to her cubbyhole as excited as her placid temperament would allow. Marius had just asked his grandfather once more for permission to make another little trip away, adding that he counted on leaving that very night. "Go," the grandfather had replied, and then Monsieur Gillenormand had added an aside, lifting his eyebrows practically to his hairline. "When it comes to sleeping away from home, he's becoming a repeat offender." Mademoiselle had gone up to her room, most intrigued, and had thrown this exclamation mark at the stairs. "That's a bit rich." And this question mark, "Where on earth does he get to?" She foresaw some affair of the heart, more or less illicit, a woman in the shadows, a rendezvous, a mystery, and she would not have minded sticking her beak in it. Savoring a mystery is like being first one in on a scandal. Holy souls are not at all averse to such things. There is, in the secret compartments of bigotry,
a certain taste for scandal. So she was vaguely gripped by a need to know the whole story. To distract herself from such prurient curiosity, which shook her up a bit more than was her wont, she had taken refuge in her talents and had set down to embellishing in cotton-on-cotton one of those embroideries of the Empire and the Restoration that involve a lot of cabriolet wheels. Dreary work, crabby worker. She had been on her backside in her chair for several hours when the door swung open. Mademoiselle Gillenormand lifted her beak. Lieutenant Théodule was before her, making her the standard salute. She let out a shriek of delight. You may be old, you may be a prude, you may be devout, you may be the aunt, but it is always nice to see a lancer step into your bedroom.
There you are, Théodule, she cried.
Just passing by, auntie.
Well, give me a kiss, then.
Here you go, said Théodule. And he kissed her. Aunt Gillenormand went to her secretaire and opened it.
You'll be staying with us at least this week?
Auntie, I'm off again this evening.
That's not possible.
Mathematically.
Stay, my darling Théodule, please.
My heart says yes, but my orders say no. It's a simple story. We're moving garrisons. We were in Melun, now they're putting us in Gaillon. To get from the old garrison to the new one, you have to go through Paris, so I said to myself, I know what I'll do. I'll go and see my auntie.
And this is for your trouble.
She put 10 louis in his hand.
You mean for my pleasure, auntie dear. Théodule kissed her a second time, and she had the thrill of having her neck grazed a little by the braid of his uniform.
And are you doing the trip on horseback with your regiment? She asked him.
No, auntie, I so wanted to see you. I've got special leave. My groom's taking my horse. I'll be going by coach. Speaking of which, I have to ask you something.
What?
My cousin, Malus Pontmercy, is traveling that way too, is he not?
How should I know?
Said the aunt. Her curiosity suddenly, violently piqued. As I was coming over, I went to the coach to reserve a seat in the coupe.
And?
A traveler had already come and reserved a seat on top. I saw his name on the sheet.
What name?
Malus Pontmercy.
That no-hoper, cried the aunt. Your cousin is not a good steady boy like you, to think he'll be spending the night in a coach.
Like me.
But you, it's out of duty. Him, it's sheer dissipation.
Goodness, gulped Théodule.
Here, something happened to Mademoiselle Gillenormand, the elder. She had an idea. If she had been a man, she would have slapped her forehead. She shouted at Théodule,
Do you know your cousin doesn't know who you are?
No, I've seen him all right, but he has never deigned to notice me.
So you'll be traveling together like that?
Him on top, me inside.
Where's this coach going?
To Les Andelys.
That's where Marius is going, then?
Unless, like me, he stops en route. I'll be getting out at Vernon to pick up the connection for Gaillon. I don't know anything about Marius's itinerary.
Marius. What a horrible name.
Why on earth did we call him Marius, whereas you, at least, are called Théodule?
I prefer to be called Alfred, said the officer.
Listen, Théodule.
I'm listening, auntie.
Listen carefully.
I am listening carefully.
Are you ready?
Yes.
Well, then, Marius often stays away.
Ha-ha!
He travels.
Ah.
He sleeps away from home.
Oh.
We'd like to know what's at the bottom of it.
Théodule answered with all the calm of a man in the artillery.
Some skirt.
And with that stifled chuckle that betrays certainty, he added, Some little minx.
Evidently,
cried his aunt, who could have sworn she was hearing Monsieur Gillenormand, and who felt her own conviction firmed up by that word minx, pronounced in almost the same way by the great-uncle and the grand-nephew. She went on.
Do us a favor. Follow Marius for a while. He doesn't know who you are, so it will be easy for you. Since there is some minx, try and see this minx. You can tell us all about it by letter. It will amuse his grandfather.
Théodule did not much like spying of the sort, but he was very much moved by the 10 louis and thought he could see more of them lining up. He accepted the commission, saying,
Just as you like, Auntie. And he added to himself,